Good morning, everyone. I feel like it's the first day of school. And, all right. Appeal 073984, RK Company versus C. It's Mr. Height. Morning, Mr. Height. Come on up.
Thank you. My pleasure to appear before this court on this historic date. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Dr. C. I really don't have a lot to say to the court today. I'm here more, if anything, to answer any questions that the court has. I tried to put all of my arguments into my brief, and my comments will be very brief. This case breaks down into two components, the first being RK Company. The nearest analogy I can come to this is the movie A Miracle on 54th Street, where there was a lawsuit over the existence and non-existence of Santa Claus. The burden seems to have been placed on my client to establish whether or not the plaintiff in this case has got the capacity or standing to sue or maintain this action. I respectfully submit that the district court erred when this was brought to their attention at the earliest moment, which was the next day after this evidence came out during the trial. And at some point in time, whether it was then or during the motion proceeding, the district court should have shifted the burden to RK Company to at least make some prima facie showing that they had some legal capacity to maintain this action.
Now, Mr. Height, would you concede that if RK Company is Mr. Krilich's, quote, doing business as alter ego, RK is able under Illinois law to sue?
If that was, in fact, the entity that was injured, I would concede that. So if it was, in fact, Mr. Krilich, and he had complied with laws of the state of Illinois to be doing business as a DBA, using his own tax ID number and such, then I would concede that it had the standing to bring the action at the time. But instead, it was brought in the name of an Illinois corporation.
Why couldn't the status of RK Company have been explored in discovery?
Your Honor, there is an RK Company that was formed before this investment was made. It is duly registered with the Secretary of the State of Illinois. I, in fact, looked up to determine when I came into the case that there was, in fact, an RK Company. And it shows a registered agent in the city of Chicago for service of process for such a company. You don't have to list all the officers, directors, shareholders, this type of thing. So there is, in fact, a company named RK Company, exactly the same name as this, that is licensed, authorized, and even at the time this lawsuit was being maintained, was in good standing in the state of Illinois to do business. It turns out that RK Company is not this RK Company.
But now that would have been discovered during discovery.
Well, Your Honor, the issue I got is they never asked Dr. C to prove that he was, in fact, Dr. C. You've not asked me, nor has anybody else in this courtroom asked me to prove that I am, in fact, Randall Height. I believe under Rule 11.
Stop, are you?
I got a piece of paper that says I am. But I might not be.
Oh, dear. Who are you?
I don't think anyone else would want to be me, Your Honor.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But I've never had a situation before where a plaintiff didn't know who the plaintiff was. It happens frequently when defendants are named, that they're named incorrectly, their legal status isn't known, it's determined during discovery that they're, in fact, a limited liability company, the pleadings are amended to correct the identity and nature of the parties, or the party may volunteer that, oh, by the way, I was erroneously sued as. But in this particular case, for basically 8 or 9 years, and through different lawyers, they continued to maintain what was in their pleadings, that they were a corporation. And only at the time of trial, when Mr. Krilich was asked, well, what is this common law trust? And as I explained to the court at that time, I didn't know what a common law trust was. And I didn't know that Mr. Bartoli, who set this trust up that was testified to, was just sentenced in this courthouse last week to 10 years, caused over $65 million in loss to the government. I was unaware that his case was pending in this court, because he was described in the trial court as being a Harvard law professor, not as a criminal defendant in a tax fraud case.
I imagine you're one and the same, but go ahead.
The minute this came to light, it was brought to the trial court's attention. We continued to proceed with the trial. It was then briefed. At no time did R.K. ever come before the court and say, Your Honor, here's a simple piece of paper. Here's our trust document. If, in fact, let's assume it was a legitimate trust, and I submit it wasn't, it either would have its own tax ID number or it would have a trustee, and the action would have to be maintained in the name of the trustee for the benefit of the trust. None of those things were done. They could have remedied any of these problems and said, listen, Mr. Heitz, you're wrong. We do have this capacity. Here, let us show you. They never did. And the trial court never requested them to.
Why did Dr. Sina try to resume Gorky's deposition if there were questions he wanted to ask? I mean, I gather that RK had already asked Mr. Gorky all of the questions it wanted to ask and then had turned Gorky over the defendants.
That was not true, Your Honor. They had not asked all their questions because they reserved the right to resume the deposition because Mr. Gorky had not produced the documents that he was required to produce in the deposition subpoena. There was an extensive amount, boxes of documents that he was to produce. One of the other counsel in the case decided to ask some questions because she had to leave due to the time differences.
But wasn't it up to Dr. C to resume the deposition if he discovered there were questions he wanted to ask?
No, because we didn't expect Mr. Gorky. Mr. Gorky was going to come testify. That's what the pretrial order provided for. Mr. Gorky was going to be here in person to testify. Dr. C would have had his right to examine him and test his credibility and his motives when he testified and if he testified as a witness. The pretrial order was very clear that no witnesses were testifying by way of deposition. But when they raised this, we were just a brief period out from the time of trial and only had a matter of days, even if the court had allowed them to resume his deposition, in which it could be completed. And those were the days in which I was having to travel back to Chicago to be here for the trial. They waited till the very last minute. They knew Mr. Gorky for 6 months was going to be needed for trial. We did the pretrial order. As a matter of fact, we had to continue the trial because RK Company had not complied with its obligations initially relative to the pretrial order. That's the second issue in this case, and that is the inconsistency in, I want to say, the sanctity of the pretrial order.
Well, when you opposed RK's motion for a videotape deposition, had the trial judge stated that he would enter the previous deposition into the record if the video didn't occur?
No. Do not believe so, no. He just decided that he was then going to receive the existing deposition into evidence over our objection that we had not been allowed to resume it or had been denied the opportunity to examine Mr. Gorky.
Getting back to your real party and interest argument, let's assume that C knew, he discovered it, he knew it. I mean, the impact of that would have been that Krillich, all he would have had to do was ratify or join or be substituted into the action.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. We're talking about a situation that goes back 8-9 years at the time this is discovered. They may or may not have been able to make a viable claim at that time. For example, I cited a case of the court in which ratifying an action or taking an assignment of it after the action's been filed, if it's filed in the name of the wrong person, does not relate back to the date of filing. So therefore, under many different reasons, there was a good chance that their claim would be time barred at that juncture.
I want to take a minute to talk about prejudgment interest.
Yes.
Because I was trying to figure out how Dr. C was prejudiced by the plaintiff's failure to include a request for prejudgment interest in the pretrial order. You know, it's a mechanical calculation. Is there something that Dr. C would have done differently had he been alerted that RK would be seeking prejudgment?
I don't know about Dr. C, but I might have done something differently. As his trial counsel, there's a number of issues that could have then been raised and briefed as to whether or not pretrial interest was warranted, the amount of time that had elapsed due to the delay in the case, resulting in basically a windfall to him because prejudgment interest was as good or better than any market rate interest that he would have gotten in conventional investments on his money and could have resulted in an unjust gain to him.
You're into your rebuttal. You may use your time any way you wish, but...
I was just answering your question.
Thank you so much. Ms. Lisher. Good morning.
Counsel. My name is Nancy Lisher, and I represent the plaintiff. Preliminarily, Your Honors, I would like to focus a little bit on the defendants. I'm so used to representing defendants, I may misspeak. The defendant has engaged in a lot of name-calling, including that the district court was confused and flustered in making its findings. It would appear that in the course of his brief, he thinks that because Robert Krillick served time after a conviction, that this somehow permanently disqualifies him from suing a wrongdoer. If this were a car accident, Your Honors, and Mr. Krillick had been hit by a car by Mr. C, then all these red herring arguments that he was making about Harvard attorneys and common law trusts, which I'll address, and he would not be precluded from suing Dr. C
if he had hit him. But given Mr. Krillick's testimony that RK Company was set up by Edward Bartoli as an investment vehicle, is there a possibility that RK is one of the common law trusts that Mr. Bartoli set up as tax avoidance vehicles, as Mr. Haidt has suggested? And is there any doubt that the Edward Bartoli that Mr. Krillick referred to as a Harvard law professor is the same Edward Bartoli who has been convicted of conspiring to defraud the United States?
Your Honor, no. This is not a common law trust. That was not the testimony at trial. There was, besides one reference about Bartoli, I don't believe, by Mr. Krillick saying he was his attorney, but he was also very clear that he did this. He did business under the name of RK Company. So all of these red herring arguments and allegations that are brought up in Dr. C's brief don't have any, and he makes these claims without citing to the record, and the reason is that it's not in the record, I would submit.
But if there is even a possibility that RK was set up as an illegal common law trust, shouldn't RK's status be sorted out once and for all, however late in the proceeding it may be? In other words, can we as a court legitimately just turn a blind eye to this, particularly in light of Mr. Bartoli's conviction? I mean, you know, there's an elephant in the room.
Well, Your Honor, there's not an elephant in the record. These arguments that have been made, again, they're not in the record. I mean, is there a possibility that something or other happened? Your Honor, I'm like you. I'm looking at this record, and this record shows that the only reference to a common law trust was on a pre-printed letterhead. The evidence was unequivocal, and all the other documents showed that RK Company was the testimony of Mr. Krillick, and the trial court did find him credible, was that this was his assumed name. He didn't understand the legal aspects. If the defendant's attorney wanted to explore this or conduct discovery, as you've pointed out, Your Honor, he could have. He made the status of the plaintiff at issue in his complaint by denying it was a corporation. He knew Krillick was the principal. The public records showed, and this is what he looked at finally in the middle of trial, that the corporation was, that the company was not a corporation. Frankly, Your Honors, my law firm had substituted in. We found out at trial when this was brought up by the defendant, so we were actually surprised. But, Judge, you can't reverse on the base of a possibility of something perhaps maybe happening, and he testified it was an assumed name. That was the testimony. And there's no question that under Illinois law, contrary to what counsel said, that people can sue or be sued under an assumed name. And they argued, well, you need a fictitious business name statement in their briefs, but that's not the law in Illinois. In Illinois, you can sue under an assumed name even if you violate the statute on assumed names. You know, Judge, he really can't decide what he wants. Are we a corporation? Are we a common law trust? He says, well, you were forced, you were obligated to provide a document showing that it was a common law trust. Well, we're not a common law trust. It was sued. This was a suit under the assumed name. But more importantly, Your Honors, the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the real party in interest issue was waived because he delayed until the middle of trial. Abuse of discretion, well, first of all, I believe, Judge Williams, you pointed out that we could have, had this been raised earlier, then under 17A, we could have either sought ratification, which effectively Mr. Krillich did by participating in this lawsuit. But in the alternative, 17A also provides for amendment, either by substitution or joinder. So it is and contrary to what counsel said, that amendment, in fact, would relate back. He did not have a statute of limitations defense. Defendant also complains that RK lacked, quote, the capacity to sue, but this is addressed by Rule 17B. It says that capacity is defined by the law of the domicile, and that is Illinois, which permits suit in an assumed name and permits you to enter into contracts as well, which is what happened here. Aside from the preprinted letterhead, everything else in this record shows that it was done in the name of RK, and the checks were paid for. I mean, the stock was purchased by Mr. Krillick. The contracts were in RK's name. There was no reference to a common law trust whatsoever. The stock certificates were not issued to a common law trust. So his whole argument about this common law trust is really dependent on a pre-printed letterhead, even though the text was clear that, and there was no reference to common law trust in that. If I could move on to prejudgment interest, my points have actually been anticipated by the court. It is black letter law in appeals that, you know, trial courts might make errors. No trial is error free, but courts do not reverse unless there's actual prejudice. In this case, there was no prejudice. It is a mechanical calculation, as this court well knows, and the defendant could have done nothing differently. He questions if it was warranted. But, of course, in this circuit, it has routinely held that victims of federal law violators is warranted and routinely granted, and this is particularly true, whereas here the trial court has found an intentional violation. Counsel also complains that there's a windfall here because of the rate of interest, which I find ironic. Under Illinois law, and this was argued in the court below but not pressed on appeal, there was a 10% prejudgment interest rate from the date of payment. So there's no windfall here. We actually got less in prejudgment interest than would have been allowed under 815 Illinois ILCS 13A. I think that's 5/13A. As for the Gorgie Depp, and that's been pretty thoroughly briefed, but it's never been clear to me why the deposition didn't get resumed, because he's up here on appeal claiming he was prejudiced, but he took careful aim at his foot and he shot it.
What was the evidentiary basis for Judge Key's determination that he was unavailable?
Well, we made that representation. He made that finding, which he, and as far as I can tell in this record, defendant never asked for an evidentiary basis. And here's my problem with this. He never ordered the transcript. It didn't get filed. The ruling on the Gorgie Depp was, quote, for the reasons stated in open court, your circuit rule 30 requires that that transcript be included in the appendix, which it was not. It's not in my record. All we really know, I think it was in the first day of trial, possibly, was that the court said, well, I found, and then he sort of generalized or summarized what his prior ruling had been, which was that he was a businessman who was going to be out of the country. Again, Judge, if the defendant wanted to make that point in the district court, he should have created a record, and he did not. You know, defendant wants to blame everyone except himself with regard to this deposition, and at that hearing, when he realized that he was going to be, that the argument was being made to have this deposition admitted at evidence, into evidence or read to the court, he should have just said, oh, I changed my mind, Your Honor, let's resume the dep. I mean, he invited the error. There's no basis to reverse here. If the court has no other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
I like Your Honor's observation that there's an elephant in the courtroom. There is. And the way you get to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. We can't stuff the whole thing in our mouth at once. What I found amazing, though, was counsel's admission that they did not know until the time of trial that RK Company was not a corporation. That's interesting because on their attorney's fees billings, in support of their attorney's fees motion, they didn't bill RK Company. They billed Royce Realty and Management Company. They weren't apparently not even being paid by RK Company.
What difference would that make?
I don't think it makes a difference. But
okay, then why bring it up?
Well, the point is that wouldn't you ask yourself, why are we billing one entity? We don't even ask our own client.
As long as I was getting paid, I wouldn't ask anybody anything.
Point, <Art. clears throat> I think it does raise a question, and that is, what is RK Company? And they never even asked that question themselves to their own client. The other thing is that if RK Company does not have the standing capacity to maintain this action, they're running around enforcing it. They've levied on an insurance policy. If the insurance company is required to report this to the IRS and needs a taxpayer ID number, they can't do it. What they're doing is they're hiding behind their lawyers and enforcing this through their lawyers, and their lawyers are collecting it. They levied on the patents in this case. Hinshaw and Culbertson got the patents, not RK Company. That's because RK Company cannot do this. But meanwhile, they're continuing to perpetrate this. As to the Gorgie deposition, I believed in the sanctity of the pretrial order. The judge had consistently ruled in favor of the finality of the pretrial order. What they came in and they made representations that Mr. Gorgie was going to be unavailable and out of the country. I don't believe they even submitted a declaration or affidavit from Mr. Gorgie that he was going to be unavailable or why he just found out about it. Thank you.
Oh, my. Thank you, Mr. Haidt, and thank you, Ms. Lisher. And the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you both. All right.